This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Until recently, today's guest did most of his lawyer work as an officer in the U.S. Army. He was assistant U.S. attorney at Fort Eustis. Then he helped head up a special unit prosecuting sex crimes throughout the military. And in his last posting, he was in Baghdad, serving as legal advisor to the Iraqi High Tribunal. But when it was time to retire from the Army, this lieutenant colonel decided to come home to Virginia and try something different. Instead of prosecuting criminals, he chose a mission to help people in need. A very specific group of people. People he believes all Americans should be thinking about with gratitude every time we turn on a light switch. Coming up, a talk with the director of the Virginia-based Black Lung Legal Clinic. But first, the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Most of us are more environmentally aware than we likely were a decade or two ago. How could we not be with all the controversies playing out in the headlines over the past few years, especially about so-called carbon-based fuels? But how often, when we flip a switch to turn on an appliance or even to literally bring light into our lives, how often do we think of the sacrifices that might have been made to give us that ease of electricity, of heat, of comfort? Well, our guest is one of those who now thinks about these types of things every day as he works with coal miners suffering from debilitating disease. So much of our focus this hour is going to be on coal, on disease, and the state of American law that connects between the two. If you have thoughts about that, questions to ask, or even a story about a particular coal miner who has crossed your path in your lifetime, we invite you to add your voice to this conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. Our guest is the director of the Black Lung Legal Clinic, based at Washington and Lee University, U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel retired Timothy McDonnell. Welcome, sir, to the Insight Studios.
Thank you.
Tim, let's start with the basics. What is Black Lung, and what is the Black Lung Legal Clinic?
All right. Well, black lung is any coal dust-induced lung disease. Traditionally, black lung used to be thought of as just that particular disease that would actually create blackness in the lungs. When an autopsy was done and you looked at the miner's lungs, you would see these flecks of black, which was anthracotic pigment or pigment from coal dust that was still in the individual's lungs. So you end up with the name black lung. But of course, that pigment isn't just sitting in the lungs. It's causing harm to the lungs. And the more traditional view of black lung, the disease called coal worker's pneumoconiosis, was the fibrotic reaction of the lung tissue to the coal dust that was breathed in. So a miner breathes in coal dust, and the body responds with an inflammatory response. It attacks this foreign body that's come in.
And may have built up over decades of work in the mines.
Day in, day out. Coal miners, especially coal miners who are working underground in what's called at the face of the mine, which is where the rock is actually being cut, are breathing in coal dust constantly. So many of the clients that we've represented, especially those who work on a device called the continuous miner, which is this enormous machine which tears up the wall and chews out the coal dust, that individual who's operating that particular piece of equipment, they'll often say, I couldn't see the man who was standing next to me. I could reach out and touch that person, but I couldn't see them because of all the dust that was in the air. And when you think about it, these individuals are thousands of feet underground. There's no place for that dust to go except into the air. And there's no way for them to breathe without breathing it in. So these individuals breathe in this coal dust. The body responds and attacks it. And it tries to digest it, and of course it can't. So sometimes what it does is it walls it off, and it creates this area of fibrosis in the lungs. And that's essentially a scar on the lungs. So that area is essentially walled off, but now you can't use that for what the lungs are there to do, which is to bring oxygen in and to take CO2 out. So that's one aspect of coal dust-induced lung disease. So this coal worker's pneumoconiosis. The other aspect, which it was only in probably the 70s, 80s, and 90s that it was recognized and fully accepted, is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is also caused by coal dust. So when we think of some of the diseases that people get from smoking cigarettes, emphysema and chronic bronchitis, you can get those same diseases from coal mining.
That first disease that I'm not sure I can even remember how to pronounce. I'll try it again for me.
Coal worker's pneumoconiosis.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to repeat that every once in a while rather than to screw it up myself. But what is thought of as classic black lung, you describe what happened to the lungs as they try to respond to this invading dust that they are under the attack with day in and day out, year after year, sometimes for decades. When a disease is finally recognized, when a coal miner has this problem built up in his lungs to the point that it's causing a problem, what kinds of problems does it cause?
Well, it's a whole host of problems with breathing. So one way to think of it is, imagine if you were to take your belt and to tighten it around your chest and then try and breathe and try and do physical activity. You're just not going to be able to do that. And essentially, someone who's having one of these conditions, it's like the tissue has all been scarred and they can't get full breaths in.
So less and less of your lungs are able to function over time.
Yes.
Less space in the lung that can actually do what it was supposed to do, as you mentioned a moment ago, metabolize oxygen and expel carbon monoxide.
Right. So what happens to the miner over time is these individuals who, as you mentioned before, I was in the military for 21 years, so I had the opportunity to work with some people who were physically tough individuals. So I think I have a sense of physically tough people, and miners are physically tough individuals. They do a job that you and I would have a hard time imagining doing one day of what a lot of coal miners do, and they do it for 20, 30, 40 years. Some coal miners that we've represented worked in what's called low coal, which means every day they went down thousands of feet oftentimes, and they were in a space that was 28 to 32 inches high, and that's where they worked all day long, you know, ripping rock out of the ground. So physically vigorous people who worked extremely hard jobs, and oftentimes they engage in physically vigorous hobbies. They hunt, they fish, they do a thing that I only discovered when I started working in the black lung field called ginsenging, which is going up into the mountains. We deal with mostly people in West Virginia, and getting ginseng root. And as the disease takes hold and has its impact, these individuals' worlds get smaller and smaller. They can't do the work in the coal mine anymore. They stop hunting. They stop fishing. They certainly don't ginseng. Then they can't garden. Then they can't go with their spouse to the store. And the condition is, it's a death by inches for these individuals. And it takes them over years where their world just gets smaller and smaller until, you know, their house becomes their world, and ultimately they pass away.
This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. My guest, if you've just joined us, is Timothy McDonald. He is director of the Black Lung Legal Clinic based at Washington and Lee University. So we have some understanding now of what black lung is. What is the Black Lung Legal Clinic, Tim McDonald, and why is it needed?
Well, I'm gonna get to that in just a second. The one part that I think I needed to explain also more clearly was the chronic obstructive pulmonary disease part of black lung, which is,
sure,
in many of the cases that we deal with, COPD is the number one problem that the miner has. And a lot of people in your listening audience, I'm sure, knows an individual who has COPD. So it's emphysema and it's chronic bronchitis. And most commonly, we're dealing with miners who have emphysema. And emphysema is the actual destruction of the lung tissue, so essentially holes in the lungs. And the manifestation is very similar. The same, I can't breathe, I can't get oxygen in, I can't get CO2 out, my world's getting smaller. But that is the area where, in the majority of black lung cases, that's certainly over 50%, the main problem is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Now, the Black Lung Clinic at Washington and Lee University School of Law has been in existence since 1996. And it came about through the work of a number of individuals. One of those individuals is Professor Uncas McThaney, who back in the 90s was doing a class on lawyers' role in social justice and social change. And one of the subjects that he'd talk about is black lung and the importance of having lawyers involved in black lung claims, because it simply was unrealistic to expect a miner to be able to go in and represent themselves in one of these claims.
Tell us what the claims are about.
Sure. When a miner reaches the point that they're totally disabled due to a coal dust-induced lung disease, they have to, if they want to get black lung benefits, they have to file a claim with the Department of Labor. When they file that claim, they then undergo a series of physical tests done by a physician identified by the Department of Labor. That includes what's called a pulmonary function test, an arterial blood gas test, an X-ray, and then they do a physical and a history. It's important to note that for minors, for anybody to undergo an arterial blood gas test, an exercise test, and also a pulmonary function test is difficult. It's unpleasant. I've undergone those tests. And then to take it to the next level, imagine if you couldn't breathe and you're still undergoing these tests. So they undergo the tests, a report is produced, and then they file their claim within the system, which has multiple levels. The first level is the district director. So that's the claim is received. The coal company or the responsible operator has a chance to respond to the evidence that's being submitted. And then this first level claims examiner determines whether they think the miner is entitled to benefits.
I'm guessing that there are a number of complexities that it would be important for us to hear about, Tim McDonald, but let me jump forward just a moment and make sure that I understand. A coal miner believes he has a disease based on breathing in coal dust for all these years that in one way or another might be determined or called black lung. He's looking to get some sort of benefits by filing this claim. If he is successful, what does he get? His medical care taken care of? Does he get some extra money to spend? What could the claim lead to?
He could receive both those things. So if you're successful with a black lung claim, all of the medical expenses related to your coal dust-induced disease will be covered. And also you'd receive a monthly stipend that is augmented if you have dependents. So the sum
about
of money—
how much money are you talking
about? Well, yeah, the sum of money is not a lot. Usually we're talking about maybe $1,000 a month. But that's a lot.
And those medical expenses that you get
those can
partial
be huge.
For.
They can be huge. So
and one of the things that—and I'm skipping around for just a moment because I know we're going to hit the break in a second, and there's just one other important factor I wanted to get your take on before we have to go to this break. It's my understanding that part of the reason that the clinic you now head was set up even before you got there was because there was an administrative judge who was looking at these coal miners filing their claims up against coal industry opposition and their teams of lawyers and saying, basically, these coal miners don't have a chance on their own. They need somebody to help them out.
That's exactly the course that was being done by Professor McThaney brought in these administrative law judges to Judge Miller and Judge Smith.
So let me ask you to continue that story when we continue on Virginia Insight in just about 60 seconds.
This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So to you who are listening, how do you feel about coal? Do you think the U.S. should be trying to use less of it? Even if you do, do you think that we as Americans owe something to those miners who've risked their lives to provide us with a primary energy source over the past 20, 30 years or more? Your opinions, as well as your questions, are welcome. 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, we are listed as Virginia Insight. And we have this question that's sort of related to what you have told us already, Tim McDonald, director of the Black Lung Legal Clinic. This is from Mike, who says, how hard is it to prove that a miner got black lung from coal dust? Don't most miners also smoke cigarettes?
Well, that's a great question, because the fact is, yes, probably 80% of miners have smoked at some point in their life. And smoking and coal mining can cause the same disease. And oftentimes that's what the controversy is. We come down to a determination, yes, this individual has emphysema. What caused the emphysema? And for a coal miner to go in and to engage the experts from the coal company in what study supports coal dust-induced emphysema versus the studies that support smoking-induced emphysema is just quite obviously ridiculous. It would be unfair. It'd be like me going in and operating a continuous miner. You know, I couldn't possibly do that. And it's entirely unrealistic to expect the miner to go in and to be able to represent themselves against highly skilled, very effective attorneys on the side of the coal company and the experts that they bring in to argue that this is not coal dust induced, it's smoking induced. For a miner to be successful, they have to establish that coal dust significantly contributed to their lung disease. It doesn't have to be the only cause. And the studies establish that coal dust and cigarette smoking have an additive negative effect on your lungs. So if coal dust causes one part of your damage and smoking causes one part of your damage, you have two parts of damage. And under the Black Lung Benefits Act, as long as you can establish that it's substantially contributed to your lung disease, you're entitled to benefit.
Let me see if I can encapsulate what I've heard from you so far, Tim. You have a miner who's maybe now 40, 50, 60 years old, who started working in the mines maybe in his early 20s, maybe even in his late teens. And for all of these years, he's been breathing in coal dust, and it's finally gotten to the point where he knows he has some sort of health condition, and he believes that it qualifies as black lung. In order to survive, he has to get extensive medical attention. He may not be able to do any kind of work anymore because he's so debilitated. So the act that you were talking about was set up so that this individual can get some assistance in paying his medical bills and get some assistance in feeding his family now that he can't work and he has a disease. Is that a fair summation?
I think that it is. And the origins of the Black Lung Benefits Act come from the Farmington disaster in West Virginia, where 78 miners were killed, and it brought to light all of these health risks that were associated with coal mining. You have the Mine Safety and Health Administration being coming into being out of these events. And also,
was this back in the 1970s?
It was actually 68, I believe, is when the collapse was. And it brought these issues related to coal mining and coal safety to national attention and ultimately caused the Black Lung Benefits Act to be passed. Going back to one of the things you had mentioned before, the origins of the clinic at Washington and Lee was a recognition that coal miners, our cases oftentimes involve 1,000, 1,600 pages worth of medical records. battles between radiologists who are looking at it at a CT scan or an X-ray and saying, I think it's coal dust induced. No, it's not. It's tuberculosis. No, it's not tuberculosis. It's I have what I call the usual suspects. I know what the coal company experts are going to say in certain cases. It's histoplasmosis. It's sarcoidosis. It's TB. It's old healed granulomatous disease. Those are our usual suspects. It's anything but coal dust induced lung disease that I'm seeing on this X-ray.
So one thing that's being implied here, but maybe it would be good to clarify, Tim McDonald, is that the coal companies almost always oppose a coal miner's ability to get his claim granted.
Yes.
And they do that because this act says that the coal company is responsible to pay the money for the medical treatment and for the living stipend.
Exactly.
If the claim is granted.
So the coal company or the insurance company for the coal company is going to be responsible for paying these benefits. So the coal company quite reasonably hires very good attorneys to represent their interests.
So, and if I understand correctly, a coal miner may have worked for several different coal companies during the course of his career before he began to get ill. Which coal company is considered responsible for paying his claim if the claim is granted?
Yeah, that's a great question. The responsible operator is the last, essentially the last coal company that he worked for a substantial enough time. So you could have a miner who worked 20 years for one coal company, works 5 years for another, and it's that last coal company that's going to be on the hook or their insurance company to pay the benefits and to pay for the medical expenses. So there's a strong incentive for coal companies to fight these claims vigorously, and they do. So they fight them, one, because they're trying to save money. They fight them, I'm sure at least somewhere in the calculus, is that the more of these claims that you fight, the less likely people are going to bring them. Because coal mining communities are small communities. When people retire from coal mining, they usually retire in the same town that they worked in. So they know all their friends who used to be coal miners. And when they're looking at their friend who's suffering from one of these diseases, is dying this through asphyxiation, and then they know that for the last 4 years they've been in a legal battle about getting benefits, you know, the miner says to themselves, do I want the pain and suffering of having to go through this prolonged legal battle? And it creates a disincentive. Who wants to go through that?
Do I understand also, Tim McDonald, that when this government program was set up, and I guess it was set up in the 1970s, that would allow a miner to file a claim, the idea was that the miner ought to be able to file the claim on his own, that he wouldn't have to go through a complicated legal process, that he wouldn't have to hire a lawyer?
I'm not sure what the idea was. You occasionally will read that in material like, well, this is intended to be essentially a user-friendly system. But, of course, it's not. And the Government Accounting Office did a review in 2008 of the Black Lung Benefits Program and recognize it's just not a tenable thing to have an individual miner represent themselves in one of these claims. So they need attorneys. Now, the problem with getting attorneys is that an attorney who represents a coal miner only receives payment if they win their claim, and they only receive payment at the end when the claim is entirely completed. In my experience, the average black lung claim takes at least 3 years to resolve, and oftentimes longer. So a lawyer who takes on one of these claims is accepting work that they're doing now that they won't be paid for another 3 years. And so there are very few lawyers who are willing to take on these claims. The miners that contact my office oftentimes state that they feel like they've called every attorney in West Virginia. And the ones that do black lung are full up, and many don't do black lung. And I would suggest the main reason is what I just described.
So in 1996, you have this confluence of events. You have at least one administrative judge who's been seeing potential black lung claimants who he thinks might well have won their cases, except that they were trying to represent themselves up against a battery of corporate lawyers and failing, saying the system isn't fair. These coal miners need help. They need legal representation. You have at least one professor, I believe, at Washington and Lee, who had a relative, maybe a grandfather, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, Professor Nacken, who's now the assistant dean for clinics at Washington and Lee. So she had a coal mining connection.
Her grandfather?
I believe it was.
And so there is this interest at your law school to set up a clinic that, one, you can meet a need that's obviously out there, but also you can give law students a very valuable experience.
You're exactly right. And that's, one of the joys of working in this clinic is how much positive results come from it. The coal miners get young people with enormous enthusiasm and energy and a keen desire to effectively represent them. And they get people who are going to take the time to listen to everything that's relevant, to hear everything that they want to say or need to say, and ensuring that they're constantly updated.
So tell us a little bit about how this works. You have, it's my understanding, Tim McDonald, that you yourself are involved in every case, but that the primary attorney, the first chair, and the second chair in any case that goes to court are senior year law students?
That's correct. So we carry about between 40 and 45 active cases within the clinic. So each student who comes in the clinic usually receives four cases that they are primarily responsible for. And they then gather all the evidence in the case. They contact the medical facilities. They get the releases. They get the documents. They get the x-rays and get them out to the experts and get the opinions, organize the entire case file. They do the motion practice. They depose our experts. They cross-examine the coal company's experts. And then they represent the miner at the hearing, where they do direct exams and opening statements and closing arguments. All of that's done with me sitting next to them, and I'm sort of the breaking case of emergency asset that's available. But so the students get the opportunity to engage in very complex civil litigation in an environment where everything that they're doing is being observed and critiqued, and the client is always going to get zealous and appropriate representation. And the students get to see what does a case look like when you have as much time in the world as is available to prepare it, and this is what it should look like when it's done. So the students get that. They also get the opportunity to work with these amazing clients that we have. So
tell me about that.
Well,
what amazing clients.
Yeah, these are people who, so many of our clients, they work 20, 30, 40 years in a coal mine. They have this enormous sense of camaraderie among their fellow coal miners for shared hardship, and also a sense that they're serving something more important than just themselves and their families, that they understand, as we all should understand, every time someone turns on a light, some of the power that's making that light go on is probably coming from the coal they dug out of the earth. And the students get to work with these people who have just amazing attitudes about life. They have great pride in what they've achieved, and also to have done the job that they did, to have raised families, oftentimes to have sent their children off to college to better lives than they had themselves. They're very close-knit to their communities, and they're very appreciative of the work that the students do with them. So it's this terrific opportunity for our students to work with people who desperately need the representation and also very much appreciate the representation that they're getting. And the clients get people who are going to spend more time than the average attorney could possibly spend on their individual case, because they're only carrying four cases, and your average attorney who's working these cases is carrying 40 or 50 cases.
How often do you win?
We win often.
What does that mean?
The average successful or the average claim that's filed, according to the Government Accounting Office, at least at the initial level, is successful about 13% of the time. In the cases that we represent, we're over 80% successful. And then we oftentimes are successful in those cases that we lose. We're successful on appeal that comes back around. But again, we have the advantage of the law students who are putting so much time and so much energy into their cases, that helps us in those statistics.
Tim McDonald, you've seen, just looking at your biography, you've seen some amazing areas of American law, and not just American law, in other places in the world. You were a kind of special prosecutor and trainer for a U.S. Army investigative unit that focused primarily on sex crimes in the military. You were actually for a while a special U.S. attorney on a military base in the Tidewater area. Your last posting, if I understand correctly, was in Iraq as an advisor to the Iraqi High Tribunal while it was going through war crimes cases. As a guy who's seen a lot of law in a lot of intense places, why are you doing this kind of work now? And what does it say about your view of the importance of black lung legal work?
Well, when I started when I thought about law school, my head was entirely directed towards the criminal law, and I thought that was sort of the alpha and the omega law. And went through law school with that in mind. I had the great fortune to be in the United States Army Judge Advocate General's Corps, and the good fortune to be allowed to focus on criminal law when I was in that area. And I sort of had that in my mind that I would just continue in this area. The opportunity to come and work at the Black Lung Clinic presented itself in my last year when I was in Iraq. And the fact that I worked a lot with expert witnesses in criminal cases made a really nice sort of segue to our cases in Black Lung, which are all about experts. It's all a battle of experts. And then I discovered how amazingly fulfilling the work was in the Black Lung Clinic. You know, I came back and I talked to my wife about it. And, you know, even though we have clients who are really suffering and desperately in need of help, at the end of the day, we're able to give that. We don't win all the time, but they know that we did everything we could to win for them, and our clients appreciate that. And at the end of the day, when we do win a case, we've given something to someone that they need. And that was, I didn't have exactly that same experience in the criminal law. A lot of times in the criminal law, there's human tragedy all around you. The Black Lung litigation certainly involves a tragedy, but at the end of the day, you can feel like I've done something good for somebody.
Tim, I only have time before we hit the break for a yes, no, or maybe answer, and then sure, we'll follow up after the break. Is it your view that the law, as set up now, is disadvantageous, is unfair to coal miners who are seeking to get claims granted?
I think it's failing in its objective.
So we'll continue with this in just a bit more than 1 minute. Tim McDonald is a former Special Assistant U.S. Attorney, a former lead prosecutor for a U.S. Army Special Investigations Unit, and former legal advisor to the Iraqi High Tribunal in Baghdad, Iraq. Today, he is a professor of law at Washington and Lee University and head of the Black Lung Legal Clinic that is based at that school. My name is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. Fair, not fair to these miners who believe they have black lung, how our legal system is currently set up, Tim?
Sure, and I think the answer has to be unfair. I say that not meaning to say anything negative about the people who work in the Department of Labor and the administrative law judges and so forth. I think everybody's trying to do the right thing. the problem is you simply cannot expect coal miners to go in and effectively represent themselves in such a highly technical area. This isn't someone going in to represent themselves for a traffic ticket where they simply say, look, I wasn't speeding, or I didn't run that light, and I have a witness who's going to say I didn't run that light. We have cases where three doctors are looking at exactly the same slide or x-ray or CT scan, and they are arriving at entirely different conclusions as to what it is. And in order to effectively represent someone in that situation, you have to dig deep into the medical science, and you have to be effective at how to use techniques of direct examination and cross-examination. So it's unfair from that perspective. The other piece of this that needs to be recognized is that the individuals who are involved in this sort of litigation have been coal miners oftentimes for 20, 30, 40 decades. And we owe those individuals a debt because of the service that they've done essentially for our country.
This is interesting, hearing a guy who spent 21 years in the U.S. Army in different spots in the world talking about coal miners as engaged in service. Is there a connection between your view of the service of the military and the service of coal miners?
Well, first, I'd say easily half of the clients that I've represented were in the military in the past. And you can see that camaraderie that is oftentimes in the military with these coal miners and the recognition that they aren't just doing any job. They understand that what they're doing is important for our nation, and our nation recognizes that because we created the Black Lung Benefits Act, because we know as a nation we need coal, and we need to take care of the people who've gotten that coal for us when they become sick because of it. It's not give them benefits because they got coal for us. It's give them benefits because they got sick getting the coal for us. And that's what the system is supposed to do, but it can't be done successfully as it currently is designed.
Why do they do it? I mean, when we started, you described people working in situations day in, day out for years or decades where they know that they are breathing in huge amounts of coal dust. They live in coal mining communities. They've seen what has happened to others who've been in that work for decades before them. They must know there's a huge risk that they're going to end up not being able to breathe someday because of the work they choose to do.
Well, that's a complex question for why would someone expose themselves to this kind of working environment. Some of it relates to job opportunities in the region that they're living in. The fact that coal mining oftentimes is the best paying job in that region. Some of it relates to family history. Many of these individuals, their parents were coal miners, their fathers. And again, there's that component, I think, of the sense of doing something that is important beyond just earning a paycheck for their family, that they understand the significance of coal to our country, and they take pride in that, and that's part of why they stay.
So to you who are listening, have you ever seen a coal mine, spoken with a coal miner? If you have, what did you learn? If you have not, now that we've got you thinking about coal mining and the people who do it, what images come to mind for you? Is this a subject you are starting to think you should have heard more about in the past? Our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have this on Facebook from Lawrence that I'm going to actually read his question, but then ask you to pause before you answer. Lawrence says, this might not be on topic, but can your guest talk some about his work in Iraq? What was it like to try to build a whole new legal system from the ground up? So we'll get to that in a moment. But before we do, tell me now how you think the legal system in America needs to change as far as coal miners and black lung disease.
Sure. The simple answer is coal miners need representation. And whether there were steps taken to create essentially a cadre of individuals who would represent coal miners who came in on black lung claims, whether it be with the Department of Labor or whatever agency, so that they would have access to legal representation when they went into these hearings, or some sort of mechanism to create greater incentives for the for other attorneys to become claimants' attorneys is necessary. Either that process or some way of shortening the lifespan of black lung claims, which would allow more attorneys to be able to come in and say, this is viable. I can take on these claims because I know within a year and a half this case will be resolved.
Is there some way to flip it around so it isn't so contentious, so that you don't have coal mining companies worrying about losing hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars over years, that maybe there's some sort of fund put up ahead of time that companies and coal miners themselves have to pay into, that's run by the government, some sort of, I don't know, Social Security specifically designed for coal mine disease? Or do you think that we need to keep the system and the adversarial legal system that we have currently?
Well, I think early on in the administration of this program, it was worked through the Social Security administration, and it was determined that was not working effectively. I'm not exactly sure why. And I would imagine it was less contentious when it was going through that process as opposed to when there's a company out there which is saying, well, this is going to come out of my bottom line, and so I'm going to vigorously defend these particular claims.
Is there also a problem here, Tim, that I don't know how anybody listening is responding to what you've heard? But I got to tell you, until the first time you and I talked a couple of weeks ago, it never occurred to me to think with gratitude toward a coal miner when I flipped on a light switch. And I got to tell you, since talking to you, I think about that all the time. It seems to me that I live in a country that doesn't give much thought to the people who may end up suffering tremendously, battling terrible disease, dying early, because they're doing something so I and other people can live in comfort.
Well, it seems that people become interested in coal miners when their big collapses. And so the Upper Big Branch collapse in 2010, there was, of course, a spike in interest in coal miners. And there were a number of stories that talked about the collapse and what caused the collapse. And obviously there's been some action directed at the people who were managing that particular coal mine. And there were still some stories later, but less sort of front page, about how many of the people in the Upper Big Branch who were killed when they examined their bodies afterwards had black lung. So you had an extremely high number, approximately 70% of those people who they could test lung tissue had evidence of black lung, and I believe three of the individuals had what's called complicated pneumoconiosis or massive pulmonary fibrosis, which is the very aggressive form of black lung. So people become aware of coal miners when there's a collapse or when there's some concern that someone's buried and they're still alive. And it would be a positive thing if people were more aware of the day-in and day-out struggles of the coal miners and the coal miners after they leave the coal mine.
So back to Lawrence's question, your time in Iraq, what was it like to try to build a whole new legal system from the ground up?
Well, I guess I had the good fortune of stepping in and working with the rule of law section at the U.S. Embassy, which is the Department of Justice. Was working on, and so had terrific people to work with. We were advisors to the Iraqi High Tribunal, which was prosecuting former members of the Hussein regime for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. And
what years? This is like 2005, 2006?
No, it was 2007, 2008 okay. That I was there. So Saddam Hussein had already been executed by the time I arrived, and we were heavily involved in the prosecution that included Chemical Ali. So it was an amazing experience to get to see another justice system, criminal justice system, after having worked in the military justice system and having done some work in the federal criminal justice system. And the Iraqi system was more based off of a civil law model, which doesn't have the same component of the adversarial aspects of our justice system. And having been a former prosecutor, I left that experience feeling very glad to be in a country that has an adversarial system and a group of individuals who are willing to be defense counsel in criminal cases, because you can see the challenges if you try and ask people to do too many things. So if you say to a defense counsel in a civil law system, yes, you're representing the defendant, but you're also seeking this notion of truth, there's a tendency for that defense counsel to be less vigorous in their representation of their client. And I saw that in some contexts. And as a prosecutor, what you want across the table is someone who is fighting just as hard as you are for their client, because you know that through that process, that's the best way to achieve justice. And as a prosecutor, I think at least my experience was, my biggest fear wasn't that a guilty person was going to go free, because our system already accepts that. The expression is, it's better for 10 guilty people to go free than for one innocent person to go to jail. My greatest fear was that I would prosecute someone and convict them and they would be innocent. And by having a vigorous defense bar and defense attorneys who are zealously advocating for their clients, that's a protection in the system. And sort of my experience left me with great affection for our adversarial process.
That's fascinating, Tim McDonald. Now director of the Black Lung Legal Clinic, but for most of your career until recently, you were a prosecutor. Your whole focus as a military lawyer was putting bad guys or people accused of being bad guys behind bars. And it sounds like you're saying that in the process of doing that for all those years, you may have seen things that occasionally made you grateful to know that there was a check on government power, that police and law enforcement authorities do sometimes make mistakes?
Of course they do, because they're human beings. And again, I sort of have an embarrassment of riches. Working in the United States Army Judge Advocate General's Corps was an amazing experience. Everybody there was committed to doing the right thing. And as a prosecutor, you learned very early on that your objective is not to convict people. You're a minister of justice. Your objective is to see that justice is done. And that includes justice to the accused, that his or her rights are looked out for, that they get a fair trial, and that the jury has all the relevant information to make the decision, and ultimately they're going to be the ones who determine guilt. Of course, I think this is true of almost all prosecutors, never prosecuted a case I didn't believe beyond a reasonable doubt that the person was guilty of, and was never asked to do anything of that nature. So being in that kind of environment was a terrific place to learn criminal law and a terrific place to practice. But even in that context, you discover that unless there are checks, unless there's someone on the other side of the table pushing, you're not going to be completely sure where the truth lies.
So after almost two decades as a prosecutor in the military, for the past few years now, you've been director of the Black Lung Legal Clinic based at Washington and Lee, a whole new focus as an attorney. We've got less than 60 seconds, Tim McDonald, for you to be in charge of the world. If you could change anything about people's perspectives, anything about the law that would serve the people who have to deal with black lung better, what would you change?
I think it's, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but the thing that I would change is that coal miners would be able to get representation in these claims. Because just as I'm committed to the adversarial process in the criminal justice system, I'm committed to the adversarial process in these black lung claims. The best way to get to the truth in one of these claims is for to have two sides that are equally matched with resources and competent counsel, and they go in and they do their best for their clients, and the judge determines the truth.
So that it's no longer a David and Goliath setup, which you believe it has been for many coal miners for many years?
Yeah, it's a David and Goliath setup for many coal miners, and David doesn't have a sling.
Our guest has been the director of the Black Lung Legal Clinic based at Washington and Lee University, Tim McDonald. Tim, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org and then clicking on programs and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Colonel McDonald is doing. Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.